Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Frank Mattel. How are you, Frank?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. You're the director of Fine and Rare Wines.
The auction house is called Heritage Auctioneers.
Heritage.
We're actually the third largest auction house in the world. We turned over $800 million last year.
Really? Because I thought it was sort of Christie, Sotheby's, Zacks, and...
We are actually bigger than Bonhams. We're bigger than all the independent houses. Most of our business is coins. We do 500 something million dollars a year in coins. Wine is a very new program for us.
Oh, okay. Well, you just did a really nice presentation at London International Wine Fair about, well, not nice, but a serious issue on fraud or some of the issues associated with wine fraud, which I've spoken to Sotheby's in the past, and they were very, there's no problems here, don't worry about it. Keep on moving sort of approach to it, which I thought was quite disingenuous. Well, I thought it was reasonably disingenuous, but what I wouldn't like to know is how big a problem is it? And one of the things you said was it isn't always about old wines.
Well, I think the problem is underreported rather than overreported. At the moment, there's a bit of sensationalist media because it's kind of a foxy, interesting thing in what's otherwise a fairly drab world of wines where people walk around drinking out of glasses with their pinkies extended, you know,
yeah.
the mystique about wine that's sort of misguided. But, you know, the truth of the matter is they're finding Jacob's Creek, inexpensive Australian Shiraz that's been counterfeited, 16,000 bottles of Sassicaia were confiscated in Italy in the year 2000. You know, there's a lot of wine out there that we don't necessarily know where it came from or how it started, but we know that it's out there. And what I was saying during the lecture is that historically you had to work on old wines if it was going to be valuable.
Yep.
You know, the only wines that were profitable at $4,000 or $5,000 a bottle were from 61, 45, 49. That's not true anymore. Now you've got 2005, 2009 Bordeaux that are selling for 15, 20,000 US a case. And that is not going to take the same amount of work.
And that is a lot easier to forge because, what, some of the things you're showing us, like the paper, is young anyway.
Well, making old wines is very, very difficult. You have to artificially age the glass. You have to age the paper. You have to age the cork. You have to come up with lead foil that is the old version of that lead foil. And you have to age. You have to oxidize this foil. That's all very, very difficult to do. But if you're knocking off new vintages, you can use brand new foil, brand new paper, brand new glass, and it's supposed to be brand new. So there's less suspicion. They're higher risk wines and they're higher targets.
Okay. And so that, it's a bit easier than perhaps these days to knock off the more recent vintages is what you're saying.
At the end of the day, you're counterfeiting wine for a profit. Nobody does this just for fun, I don't think.
Mm.
If you're turning out wines that are not correct for the purpose of making money, you want to make as much money for your effort as possible.
Yeah.
And there are inexpensive versions of wine that could be rebottled, relabeled, sold to the masses, and ultimately put by the people who are consuming these very, very rare and expensive wines.
One thing that I think is quite interesting is that refilling old bottles, because you've got the right glass, you've got the right paper. If you use the right equipment, you can pretty much use the same cork almost, sort of.
Yeah.
The only thing you're really worried about is the foil. And you were saying, you know, you can take it off and put it back on very carefully. And
well, not old foil. Old foil is very, very difficult. To be honest, you know, I'm not endorsing anybody going out trying to make these counterfeits. But, you know, going through the exercise of stretching the foil, taking it off and trying to get it back on a bottle, you learn a lot. And I have not been able to find anything that'll artificially make these wines, these foils, look genuine to a period. You know, the glass, it's either from the 50s and it was hand-blown or it isn't. And the label is either old paper or it's not. Those are all things that you can test for. The foil is very, very difficult.
Yeah, it was interesting. You were saying you showed us one bottle that you said, look, you think the glass is right, you think the label's right, and we tried the wine and it looked... tasted it like an old wine to me.
Sure.
It's not sort of old wines that I drink regularly, so it's about out of my experience to know whether it was or not. But then at the end, you scratch the label, and then all of a sudden, you could see there was bright white paper underneath.
Yeah.
So even that label fooled you for a wee bit until we'd sort of scratched it. So
well, I mean, these things, you know, the good news is they had already been identified as counterfeits.
We weren't worried
about it. But the wine was 61 Opryon. And the thing is, Opryon has a very unique shaped bottle. To those ends, there is some measure of difficulty that most people aren't going to try and overcome. If you've got a unique shaped bottle, you really have to start with an authentic bottle. You couldn't reproduce a bottle that's shaped differently or that has those reliefs. Oprion has that emblem
yep.
on the neck that would be awfully difficult to replicate if you were to try and make the wine all over again from scratch. But yeah, the label looked period. Everything looked genuine about the bottle. What was inside it was clearly not 61 Oprion. You know, maybe it was 66 Pop Clément or something from a neighboring vineyard, similar type of age to it. And you know, somebody without looking at that cork and capsule that was the real telltale could have been fooled.
One of the things you said was always a good idea to look at a bottle and get a couple of telltale signs, or not telltale signs, but things that you're particularly aware of. You mentioned sort of some underlying red, you know, the in Petrus where they have the shadowing, you know, three lines, make sure that the ink is good quality, all that sort of stuff, not blurred.
Yeah.
But other examples. If you're not really in the trade, though, it's really hard to get a handle on that sort of thing.
Well, one of the problems that we face is exactly that, trying to find an authentic exemplar that you can use as a measuring stick, yeah? If you take a look at some of the ancient vintages of DRC, there are natural differences in those labels because they were manufactured in an old-fashioned way on an old-fashioned press at a time that the estate really didn't have any money. There are differences in those labels that are very, very hard to quantify as categorically correct, authentic, genuine, or categorically incorrect, or what we say inconsistent with what it should have been for the vintage. But, you know, everybody has to be able to maintain a certain small amount of information that'll at least get them asking the right questions so that with the use of the internet or colleagues or other collector friends, you can ask the right questions to hopefully make a good decision about the provenance of the wine.
What are the key questions from your point of view?
The most important thing is asking where the wines were purchased. You have to know your sources. There are some wine merchants who are very, very honest people who thought that they had a great source for old wines, and it turned out to be incorrect. There are some people who are not as honest, but where the wine came from will tell you a lot. You know, if you bought 59 Lafitte on Premier, your grandfather bought it, kept it in his cellar all of its life, you have a pretty good indication that this wine is going to be sound. If somebody had bought a collection inside the last few years, picking things up at auction here and there, the exposure and the risk is higher. It's not to say that the wines are categorically better or categorically worse, but there's more exposure than a bottle that had been sitting in the same place for 60 years waiting for you to come find it.
When you say exposure, you mean exposure of the wine being swapped or...
Swapped, replicated. You know, there's all kinds of things that happen. You know, 67 Petrus is a fantastic wine, and it costs 75% less than the 61. You could very easily make a 67 look like a 61, and it has happened. And some people, even experienced tasters, wouldn't be able to tell you that it wasn't 61 Petrus. You know, these are things that happen, and being aware is what helps you make sure that you've protected your investment.
One of the things you said earlier was you're talking about the old English and French collections. You talked about Andrew Lloyd Webber's
yes.
collection and other things, and you're sort of saying that these collections are now becoming a thing of the past, and then it's a problem because you're saying that wines that are in America, for example, and collections have been built up in America over the years now, they're not as valuable or...
No, what I was trying to describe is the trend for these wines to be traded around now. You know, historically, especially in the UK and France, it was common for a wine collector to buy every vintage. And you put it under the house, and you drank the bad vintages while you waited for the good vintages to mature. Those are what we call first owner wines. They were purchased by one guy, and they stayed in the family forever and ever and ever and ever. The problem is that a lot of those wines got to be very valuable, and they've only really come to be grossly valuable in the last couple of decades. But these people were sitting on massive, massive assets. It was a lot of money. In the advent of the New York wine buying scene and the Hong Kong wine buying scene, it got to a point where the families were happy to liquidate half of it. So there's not as much old sellers lying
yep.
around. A lot of these collections that are mega, they may have the most fantastic wines sourced carefully. It's not a matter of whether they're authentic or not authentic, but they're not first owner wines. And those are the sellers that really, really pull out the stops. Those are the wines that people jump all over each other to purchase because you're more likely to get a better experience out of those wines.
if wines are getting traded more and more and more, then there's obviously a bigger opportunity for wines to be interfered with or swapped or whatever the problem is.
Yeah.
One of the solutions to that, I suppose, is to have repositories of wine in storage when the ownership has changed. The wine doesn't move, but the ownership changes. Is that not used a lot, or?
I can only speak for myself and a select few people that I'm really, really close with. I want my wines in my house. I want to be able to touch them and play with them. I mean, wine is a compulsive collectible. There aren't many people who buy it for the sake of putting it on a shelf. Even the guys that are buying trophy wines as trophies, they're drinking them. It's part of life. You know, when the economy turned down, a lot of the other collectible categories had a lot of material. People needed to raise funds, so they sold paintings, houses, cars. Nobody wanted to sell wine, number one, because you can't replace it. Number two, because these are wines that you've put time into their maturity. You know, it's a very proprietary interest that people have in these wines. And also, selling wine in bulk is a pain. It's very, very difficult. You can pull a painting off the wall and it might be $100,000 or $1 million. $1 million worth of wine is a substantial commitment of time to get sold.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's important to note that these repositories, as you've described, it's a great idea, but the Communist Manifesto was a great idea too. It's just not something that's likely to work. And it's not just about counterfeiting. It's also about storage conditions. It's about wines that are getting traded, and one day they sit on a dock waiting for a truck, and that one day exposed to 90 or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, sort of 45 degrees Celsius, that wine's life is changed forever. That's what we're really trying to get down to, is nailing down provenance as a function of pouring a good drink, not just counterfeit, not counterfeit.
You actually had a really good point about, in terms of getting a wine, freeze it, thaw it, freeze it a few times, and then cook a bottle. You said put it in the microwave?
Yeah, you can put it in the microwave, you can put it in the oven, you can just leave it in the sun. You know, the idea is you have to be able to recognize the things that go wrong. Every staff member that works with me goes through these exercises because I need them to recognize heat damage, freezing damage.
To the shape of the bottle, to the label, or to the content?
To everything. To everything, everything. By, you know, you learn by exception. You know, I mean, you don't learn that fire's hot by looking at fire. You learn by putting your hand in it, by experiencing it. And, you know, if somebody asks you to describe what a corked wine tastes like, if you've had a bunch of them, you'd be able to describe it. It may be clumsy and it may not be eloquent, but you'd roughly be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
If somebody asks you what heat damage tastes like and you don't know what heat damage tastes like, you are not equipped to sell these wines to the caliber of clientele that want to buy fine and rare wines. You need this information. This is how you protect yourself, and this is how you protect your consumers.
So you're saying get yourself a cheap bottle of wine, freeze it, see what happens, cook it up. Good advice.
Freeze and cook wines and drink them side by side. It's not just about freezing it and tasting it. Three bottles, one that's a control bottle that's going to be left alone, one that's frozen, one that's been exposed to extreme heat. And you drink them all together, and they will be different. And those differences are the things that you commit to memory.
Yep. No, that's a good point. What about talking about Hong Kong and China? Because at the moment, that seems to be the hotbed of counterfeit. You know, people talk about more Lafite in Hong Kong than produced in vintages.
Sure, sure.
Sort of situation. If I was a wine investor, I'd be very nervous about buying wines that have come back from Asia, not just because of their potential heat damage.
I understand, and that's a relatively common perception. I have to be honest, it's not entirely fair. I mean, there are counterfeiting problems, and we all know from Gucci to Rolex that Asia is the source for a lot of the counterfeits that are out there in luxury goods. It cannot be denied. But there are a lot of extremely passionate collectors over there who are taking as good or better care of their wines as well.
Oh, I've been
asking questions. You know, when somebody says that their wine has been stored at Crown Wine Cellars,
yep.
I'm not worried about whether that wine has been exposed to heat or not.
Yeah, I've been to Crown Wine Cellars in Hong Kong. Beautiful layout.
It's a fabulous facility. It could be the best wine storage in the world. It's just about being able to go in there and know how it got there as well. You know, one of the things that Greg Dieb, the managing director of Crown Wine, will tell you is that suddenly the floodgates opened. When the duty dropped to zero, there were hundreds of thousands of cases. I mean, hundreds of containers thrown on the ocean of wines that had been stored at Octavian or not stored at Octavian, stored at London City Bond or where have you, that had never been inspected before. And they all arrived at the same time. I think moving forward, a lot of those wines will get a lot more attention. But I think there are a lot of people that imagined there being a sterile environment in Hong Kong, not realizing that we don't know what was shipped to Hong Kong. And there's thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of, or maybe millions of bottles that have not been looked at and may not be looked at.
What do you mean looked at in terms of from a counterfeit point of view or just from a quality, damage, and transit point of view?
No, I think when the duty was at 80%, people would buy wines and leave them at Octavian.
Yep.
Right? Octavian has fantastic storage. And at some point, when the duty shifted, they released the wines from Octavian and they brought them home. Those are wines that presumably you trust. They've been sold by good merchants. They've been stored in a good place. But not everybody's wine came out of Octavian. There are less scrupulous storage facilities that were warehousing wine as well. Does it necessarily mean that something's fake? No. I do know that there are people who bought Lafitte and were delivered Carouade de Lafitte. I know that there are people who bought 05s, received 04s. You know, these are things that happened because somebody didn't have the time to inspect the purchases correctly.
Yep.
That was a one-time problem, and it's a big problem. But I don't think it's fair to suggest that Hong Kong necessarily is going to create a brand new problem that didn't exist. It's not really on the heads of the very sophisticated collectors who are out there.
And just looking at the future, one of the problems obviously with counterfeit is determining what is counterfeit and what is not. There seems to be two main ways of trying to work out whether it's counterfeit or not. One is to try and examine the wine on the outside, and one is to get inside and do some analysis.
Right.
Of the wine. From your experience, what do you think is working or not working? Or, you know, when you taste a wine, you're saying, oh, it wasn't this wine, so you know it. But that...
I don't really have a grip on the science, to be honest. You know, I got through college by drinking, and that's how I prepared myself for my future in the wine business, you know?
But, I like it.
But at the end of the day, you know, it's really, really hard to measure something that you can't touch. You know, finding a non-invasive way of measuring the bottles in a science fiction novel is absolutely the solution. You know, a version of the Star Trek tricorder, something that you could hold up to the bottle and it'll tell you that what's inside the bottle is correct or not correct for what it's supposed to be. But, you know, at the moment, there are reliable ways of going through a cork without damaging the wine, extracting less than a milliliter of wine, and finding conclusively what's inside. It is possible. It's just very, very difficult to market to a collector base that's afraid that the wines are going to be destroyed.
Yeah, no, I can imagine they'd be a bit nervous, particularly if they've got a lot of money invested in it.
Well, you wouldn't use this technology to test 5- and 6-pound bottles of wine. You're testing your 47 Petrus. And if your 47 Petrus, number one, comes out wrong, you've got a problem. But number two, if you destroy the bottle in order to examine it, then you've actually accomplished nothing because the wine's destroyed. And it doesn't matter what the result of the test is.
And just before we finish up, what do you think of the new movie coming out starring Brad Pitt, Billionaire's Vinegar? You're going to be watching that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a fascinating story. And, you know, look, one of the things that people have to appreciate is that counterfeiting in wine goes back thousands of years. It's been happening for ages. The idea is that now we're aware, we're developing technology, we're developing protocol. We have the opportunity to regulate ourselves or introduce some sort of oversight where we have people providing a protocol for us to handle these things. It had to happen, and it'll be better for the industry over the long haul now that we are addressing it as a very real concern.
Okay then, Frank. I'll let you go. I know you've got to dash off, but thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Chris.